From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's edition of Fresh Air, I speak with singer-songwriter and guitarist Loudon Wainwright III. His songs are known for their humor and sometimes caustic satire. Also today, I talk with poet Mark Halliday. His first book of poems, Little Star, draws inspiration from popular culture and rock and roll. Accordionist William Schimmel plays a couple of tangos, and critic-at-large Laurie Stone analyzes the humor of comic Harry Shearer. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. My guest is singer-songwriter and guitarist Loudon Wainwright III. He's best known for the novelty hits Dead Skunk in the Middle of the Road and I Wanna Be on MTV, but most of his songs are too idiosyncratic for the pop charts. He writes social satires, as well as humorous, sometimes depressive songs about his own life. Rock critic Ken Tucker said of Wainwright, "No pop songwriter has written about marriage and parenthood with more honesty, with more pain, joy, and frustration." Such songs can be heard on Wainwright's new album, More Love Songs, just released on the Rounder record label. Over the last 12 years or so, Wainwright has returned to one of his earlier passions, acting. He appeared in several episodes of MASH, an off-Broadway production of Harold Pinter's The Birthday Party, the musical Pump Boys and Dinettes, and he also had a supporting role in the film adaptation of the Neil Simon comedy, The Slugger's Wife. Loudon Wainwright III is the son of Life magazine writer Loudon Wainwright. Loudon Wainwright is currently based in London. He's now touring the States, and he's brought his guitar and is going to play a few songs for us. Loudon, welcome to Fresh Air. And before we talk, can I ask you to open with a song?
Sure.
Why don't you do one from your new record?
Okay, this is called Unhappy Anniversary. Unhappy anniversary, it's 1 year since we split. I walk and talk and get around, lie down, stand up and sit. I eat and drink and smoke and sleep and live a little bit. Unhappy anniversary, it's 1 year since we split. Unhappy anniversary, it's 10 years since we met. There is no need to remind me, no way I could forget. We fell in love, then we fell out. Both times there was no net. Unhappy anniversary, it's 10 years since we met. Unhappy anniversary, I cannot count the days and nights that I have thought of you since we went separate ways. I tell my mind to forget you, but my heart disobeys. Unhappy anniversary, I cannot count the days. Unhappy anniversary, it's 1 year since we split. I walk and talk and get around, lie down, stand up and sit. I eat and drink and smoke and sleep and live a little bit. Unhappy anniversary, it's 1 year since we split.
That sounds great. That's Loudon Wainwright performing live in our studios. You know, your new album is almost like a concept album of someone who's turning middle-aged, who's recently divorced, is a father, kind of depressed about the whole thing. Do you see it that way?
Is it that bad? Did it come across that bad?
No, I mean, there's some very humorous stuff on it, too, but it does seem as a kind of concept album about where you are now in your own life.
Well, it's called More Love Songs, and it does, a lot of the songs are kind of deal with a particular relationship and the breaking up and what follows, and I think it's quite a dark record. I agree with you, and it should be listened to with caution.
You write very personal songs, and there are periods in pop music where most songs seem to be about relationships, mostly about falling in love.
Yeah,
and I think you've been able to take songwriting into other areas, which is very difficult to do.
Mm.
Yeah, well, I've written a lot of love songs. I mean, I had another album of love songs that was called Unrequited, and I think that's a lot of the love songs that I do write are have to do with kind of the darker aspects of it. But I don't know really what the heck I'm doing.
You have a song on your new album called The Back Nine that's
right.
Kind of golf as a metaphor, the back nine being an almost metaphor for the second part of life and fumbling your way through it. And I was wondering if you were depressed about getting older.
Well, I'll tell you. No, I feel great about getting older.
Okay.
I have to write about what you know about. And I, like everyone else, I'm focused, particularly since I just had my 40th birthday.
Right.
I'm focused on the back nine of my life, I suppose. And I write about it. I mean, these songs, people do call them depressing or something. But you got to remember that they're exaggerations of things to a certain extent. They're rooted in real things. But I'm not the suicidal, depressive guy that I sometimes seem in these songs.
I think it was when you were 30, you wrote Watch Me Rock, I'm Over 30.
Yeah.
And that kind of raised questions of, well, you can still play. You can still sing and play rock and roll when you're over 30. You must feel like you were very young when you were thinking you were getting older.
Yeah, well, I'm very focused on myself. I'm a very selfish person. These songs come out of my dinky little life. I mean, but it's all I have to work with.
You know what I'm thinking? Like, so many of us are preoccupied with what happens to rock and roll when the people get older. And I think part of the reason for that preoccupation is that initially rock and roll is for teenagers and all the adults liked a different kind of pop. And it was assumed that when the teenagers became adults, they'd have to like what their parents used to like.
Yeah, yeah.
Do you have problems with what does a rock and roller do when they get older? Is that a big question?
I don't have any problems with that. I mean, I like music if it's good, and you know, there's a lot of great older people out there playing, swinging older people. You know,
you're living in London now, and do you think of yourself as an expatriate? Have you left for good?
No, I don't think so. I think I just wanted to get out of the United States for a while for some personal and professional reasons, and just spend some time over there. I've enjoyed being over there. I've worked on my last two albums with Richard Thompson. And another friend of mine who's based over there, a guy named Haim Tannenbaum. And I have a pretty good following over there, and they speak English, so hey, it's my kind of place.
I want to ask you to play another song.
Yeah, I'll play another song from this record of mine, or that's on this record of mine. Let me just tune a little bit.
While you're tuning, I'll reintroduce you. My guest is Loudon Wainwright, and he's performing live for us. And the song he's going to play is also featured on his new album, which is called More Love Songs.
Your mother and I are living apart. I know that seems stupid, but we weren't very smart. You'll stay with her, I'll visit you. At Christmas, on weekends, in the summertime too. Your mother and I are not getting along. Somehow, somewhere, something went wrong. Everything changes, time takes its toll. Your folks fell in love, love's a very deep hole. Your mother and I will do all we can do to work this thing out and to take care of you. Families get broken, I know it's a shame. It's nobody's fault though, and you're not to blame.
Your mother and I are both feeling bad, but things will get better, they won't stay this sad. And I hope when you grow up, one day you'll see your parents are people, and that's all we can be. Your mother and I.
It's a really moving song. Do you know if your ex-wife and your child have ever heard the song yet?
Oh, yeah. They're some of my biggest fans.
Oh, good. My guest is Loudon Wainwright, who's playing for us live. Let me ask you about your past. Let's talk about your life a little bit. Your father is Loudon Wainwright, the Life magazine writer, who's
right.
a very well-known journalist. Did you start writing when you were pretty young?
Not really. My intention in life was to be an actor. I knew I wanted to be in show business, and I thought I was going to be an actor. In fact, I went to and studied acting at Carnegie Mellon in Pittsburgh, which at that time was the late 60s, was a very, very good drama school. I think it still is. But I dropped out of acting school in the late 60s and kind of became an itinerant hipster, you know, went out to San Francisco and did that whole thing and hitchhiked around and then fell into playing the guitar and writing songs. I had never thought I'd make a living doing that. And then, I, as you mentioned, I kind of returned to acting with the MASH things and whatchamacallit, but I'm still primarily earning my living as a musician.
The way you say you fell into writing songs, it sounds like you had no idea you could either write, sing, or play.
Well, I knew I could sing and play. I had learned how to play the guitar in boarding school when I was a younger teenager and had little folk bands and stuff like that. I didn't think I could write. I was living in a, staying with a friend in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and he had a guitar there. So I remembered my five chords, which are the five chords that I still use, by the way. And I picked up the guitar and wrote this terrible song about a lobster fisherman that I knew in Rhode Island. But it was enough to get me interested in the idea that all of a sudden, wow, I can write a song.
Oh, the temptation is for me to embarrass you and ask you to play the first verse of it.
Luckily, I've forgotten that entire song. But it was enough. I had written a song, and this was a great, exciting thing. And then I just started to write 5 and 6 songs a week. I became obsessed.
You said you wanted to be in show business, and I wonder if you think of what you're doing now as show business. Show business also implies your suits and cufflinks and a much more
Vegas-y type thing.
Thank you, Vegas-y. Yes.
Well, I think it is show business. I mean, it's the business and the job of doing a show. And as I said before, a lot of these songs may paint a picture of me as, well, at least the two that I've played this afternoon, you might think that I'm suicidal or something. But the whole thing is
and in fact, you have written songs about suicide.
Yeah, I have. I mean, I present a character, actually, is what I do. And I probably shouldn't be divulging this. But yeah, that's what I do. That's what everybody does. I mean, it's all show business. Jim and Tammy is show business. Mr. President is show business. I mean, I think it is a bit, you know, as long as people are observing it and sitting down or paying for it, it's show business, no matter what it is.
When you started playing, you were playing at some of the coffee houses in Greenwich Village and playing small clubs. It was a period, I suppose this was during the late 60s or so.
That's when I started, yeah.
There was a period when a lot of bohemianism was about severing all ties to the middle class.
Mm-hmm.
And you came from an obviously middle class background, but your father was well known enough that it would have been hard to act as if you were from this mysterious background, which
the
is
Delta,
what a lot of people were doing. Even Bob Dylan did that. He changed his background completely. Did that stand in your way, or did you ever wish you could come from a less explicit
No,
past?
In fact, I utilized that. I mean, I came from the from Westchester County, New York, which is a very affluent suburb of New York City. And I wore Brooks Brothers shirts and wingtip flyers and, you know, gray flannel pants. And did then and still do write songs about golf courses. I mean, I've drawn on my background of being a white middle class guy from the suburbs. I mean, I've used it, and because that's what I know, that's what I am,
and that's what you're going to write about.
Yeah.
My guest is Loudon Wainwright, and he has his guitar with him. He's going to perform a couple of more songs a little later in the program. He also has a new album called More Love Songs. We're going to take a short break, and we'll be back in a few seconds. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live from WHYY in Philadelphia and is distributed by National Public Radio.
My guest is singer, songwriter, and guitarist Loudon Wainwright. And Loudon, can I ask you to do another song for
us? Sure. Let me just. Yeah, this song is called "I Eat Out." I'm on a tour now, and I'm spending a lot of time eating in restaurants by myself.
I can cook a little, but it's not a lot to shout about. It's kind of mean cuisine, so I eat out. Hey, they know me at the Greek and the Chink and the Itai and the Indian too. And they all say, here comes that sad American man again, what are we gonna do? Well, you can put me in the corner, in the table, in the back, unless you got one in a telephone booth. I'm here and I'm alone again, it's sad, but it's the truth. No, I'm not expecting anyone. Is that beyond belief? Give me the menu. Take away the candle. Never mind the aperitif. They got a couple of couples, a trio, and a foursome. They even got a party of eight. I'm getting that look. I wish I'd brought a book. Better yet, I wish I'd already ate. Polite. What's the matter with you people? You're telling jokes and you're holding hands and you're talking with your mouths full. Well, the waiter comes up and he asks me, how is it, sir? Is everything all right? The food's fine, but I feel like a fool because I'm eating alone tonight. Don't say I was here at all. What would all my loved ones think? I'll take a check, no sweet, no coffee, no after, then I drink. I can cook a little, but it's not a lot to shout about. Oh, it's kind of mean cuisine, so I eat out.
Great song. It's a wonderful song. This song really reminds me of all the efforts I've gone through eating alone, trying to prop up a book against ketchup bottles so I can read and act invisible.
It's a very embarrassing thing, eating alone.
It is. And people have a way of making you feel embarrassed, too, sometimes.
Yeah.
Let's talk some more about your life now. Your big hit in the early 70s was Dead Skunk in the Middle of the Road.
Yeah.
And I'd like to ask you how you wrote the song.
Well, I ran over a skunk that had already been run over, I guess, a few times. And for some reason, went home and in a matter of 12 minutes, wrote this song, which will probably be on my epitaph or something. I don't know. It was just one of those things. Quite often, the songs come very quickly, and I just wrote this silly little nonsensical song, and just in under 20 minutes, couldn't have been more than 20 minutes. And then I started to sing it in clubs and stuff, and people reacted very strongly. So I knew that maybe there was something to it all. But it's strange. I mean, if I had to have a single, I'm kind of proud of the fact that it's a song called Dead Skunk in the Middle of the Road, I think, in a way. And it was fun to do it, although the problem is that I was quite young when it happened. And, you know, the record company wanted to know, when I delivered my next album, where the Funny Animal song was, you know, they, in their minds, that's basically what I was going to be, which was a total novelty songwriter.
So that can be, a hit can be like a noose around your neck.
Yeah, it can, you know.
A little overdramatic there, wasn't it?
Yeah, well, it creates difficulties, particularly if you're not ready. And I don't think I was ready, but I'm ready now.
That's right.
Can I have my hit now? I'm ready.
Do people still force you to sing it when you play clubs?
Nobody forces me to do anything. I do still sing it, though, because I went through a period where I refused to sing it. I became very rebellious about the whole thing because it went to number 12 nationally, but in some parts of the country, for instance, in Little Rock, Arkansas, it was number one for 6 weeks in a row. So I really developed a kind of a perverse attitude about the whole thing. But now, in an emergency, I'll certainly play it. You know, if things aren't going too well in a show. And sometimes I'm in the mood to play it. It's a good audience sing-along song.
Should I or should I not ask you to do a chorus of it?
In case people don't remember it?
Yeah.
Well, there has to be a reason, doesn't there? You want the chorus or a verse?
A verse. And my guess is Loudon Wainwright.
You see, my body's rebelling and my guitar's out of tune. Here it goes.
Crossing the highway late last night. You should've looked left and you should've looked right. Didn't see the station wagon car. The skunk got squashed and there you are. You got a dead skunk.
And everybody out there in Radio Land has got to sing in on this one.
You got a dead skunk in the middle of the road. Dead skunk in the middle of the road. Dead skunk in the middle of the road. Stanking the high heaven.
You want more?
That's fine. Because I want to save some time for a new song at the end.
Okay.
But thanks for doing that. It's actually a very enjoyable song.
No, it's not a bad song. In fact, it's very cathartic for me to do it.
Good. I'm glad I gave you that opportunity. Was it a big decision to you when that was a hit, whether you were going to try to deliver the next Animal Novelty song or just keep going your own way?
One more time, ask me that again.
Did you have to make a decision whether you were going to try to keep delivering novelty hits?
Well, I was in conflict for a number of years. I certainly didn't try to make another hit Animal song, but I certainly felt under pressure to come up with a hit single. And I think that was a mistake on my part, probably. Rather than just writing the songs and trying to make the best records possible. That's one of the problems when you're in the big commercial world out there, you know, you're expected to duplicate your successes and take whatever you do and make it palatable for everybody.
You're really a very, I think, idiosyncratic songwriter and performer.
Thank you.
Yeah, I mean that as a compliment. And I think we're living in a world that's getting more and more homogenized where it's more and more difficult to go your own way. Are there enough like clubs and colleges left where you can perform now that the quote folk revival and the folk rock scene aren't what they used to be?
Yeah, well, in England, interestingly enough, they're saying there's a resurgence of that, although I've heard that before. When I travel by myself, there are plenty of places I can play and it all becomes economically feasible. At the moment, in some of the places I'm going, I'm taking two other fellows with me. And so you have the economics of three hotel rooms and plane tickets and stuff. And then it becomes hard. But as a solo guy, it's not tough, really. And I'm lucky because there are a lot of places that I can play. I also play a lot in Europe. And I'm going to Japan in July for the second time and Australia. And so there's work out there for me.
Great. I'd like to ask you to play a new song, if you would. One that you haven't recorded yet. Would that be okay?
Sure. Tune again.
Okay. Guess I keep asking for songs.
The great thing about my
album
is that there's absolutely no tuning on it. We cut all that out.
Loudon Wainwright is my guest, and he has a new album which is called More Love Songs. He's performing for us live today.
This is called Mind Read.
I knew I forgot something, I guess I always do. I'm so absent-minded when it comes to you. I forgot I promised to fulfill your need. Thank you for reminding me your mind is hard to read. But it was what attracted me to you. Don't you forget I knew you had a problem. The moment that we met, you thought that I could solve it, but I doubted that was true. That thing was bigger than us both, and it belonged to you. Yeah, it belonged to you. Yeah, it belonged to you. But I'm at your disposal, that's part of our deal. I'll try not to despise you, I know what it feels like. If you have a breakdown, I can make it well. If you've got an ugly secret, well then I'm the one to tell. And there's politics involved in this, and economics too. Theatrics and aerobic exercises to go through. It's like climbing mountains and falling out of trees. It can take your breath away, but it can scab your knees, yeah. Scab your knees, yeah. Scab your knees, yeah. And they used to say that God is love, and probably they still do. But if you ask me, love is when I get along with you, and that is never easy. Sometimes it's a chore. Cause after everybody's had enough, you want some more. I knew I forgot something, I guess I always do. I'm so absent-minded when it comes to you. I forgot I promised to fulfill your need. Thank you for reminding me you're mine. Yeah, you're mine. It's hard to read. Yeah, it's hard to read. Hard to read.
I think that's one song I won't ask about the occasion that got you to write it.
I'm not sure what that's
about, even. A relationship that wasn't going very well, huh?
Another one of those, I'm afraid.
Tell me about how you write songs. Do they come to you whole?
No. I'll get an idea. I mean, even a line, you know, or a first line, that is, which may necessarily wind up being the first one, but and then I'll just expand on it and work on it and kind of. And then there's a kind of a gestational period where I'll just think about it for a while, or a gestation period where I'll just think about it. And then they just kind of, you pull it all together. Then you take it out, or then I take it out and play it for people and see how they react and what works and what doesn't work. Then you change it some more, and then it's usually done or you forget about it.
Well, I've enjoyed your performance very much today, and I really want to thank you a lot for visiting with us on Fresh Air.
Well, thanks. I've enjoyed being here.
That was an encore presentation of an interview and performance with Loudon Wainwright III, recorded during his recent American tour. Wainwright is currently touring the British Isles. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On our next show, I'll speak with guitarist Ron Wood. He played 7 years with Rod Stewart, 12 years with the Rolling Stones.
Funding for Fresh Air is provided by a major grant from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and a grant from Fisher's World Travel Guides. Fisher's World Guidebooks, featuring the removable travel planner designed for the intelligent, inquisitive traveler. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio. Thank you.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Coming up, poet Mark Halliday reads Little Star, his homage to the 1958 doo-wop hit by The Elegants. Also, William Schimmel of the Tango Project stops by to play a couple of tangos, one a traditional number from Argentina, the other one of Schimmel's own compositions. And critic-at-large Laurie Stone reviews comic Harry Shearer's stand-up act. Most fans know Shearer as a former cast member of Saturday Night Live and as the co-star of the heavy metal spoof This Is Spinal Tap. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
I'm Ann Bozell in Washington. In Oakdale, Louisiana, negotiations between Cuban inmates and federal officials have still not produced an expected agreement to end a week-long siege at a federal detention center. But officials say they're optimistic more talks today will result in a settlement. Last night, in a videotape message, negotiators said a tentative agreement had been reached. Inmates there are holding 26 hostages. They released one today after he was stabbed by an inmate. The hostage situation in Atlanta seems to be at a standstill. Formal negotiations broke off after Cuban prisoners held a mass meeting and voted against a proposal to free 50 of their 94 hostages. The mayor of Miami and Cuban American exiles arrived in Atlanta today, offering themselves as hostages in place of the others. But a Justice Department spokesman says that offer has been rejected. Two French journalists were released today in Beirut by their pro-Iranian captors. The BBC's Jim Muir reports.
Expectations have been rising throughout the day since the kidnapped group, calling itself the Revolutionary Justice Organization, had announced that it was about to free its remaining two French hostages. But it wasn't until shortly after nightfall that two cars full of gunmen drew up outside a seafront hotel on the southern outskirts of Beirut, dropped the two hostages, and sped off. One of them, Jean-Louis Normandin, a member of a television crew, had been missing since March 1986, when he was seized by gunmen along with three colleagues who have since been released. The other, Roger Ouk, was covering the last visit to Beirut by the Archbishop of Canterbury's special envoy, Terry Waite, in January, when he, a photographer, was kidnapped just a week before Mr. Waite himself went missing. The French government has been involved in lengthy and discreet contacts over the hostages involving both Syria and Iran, and there's some speculation that the release may mark the beginning of a thaw between Paris and Tehran.
The BBC's Jim Muir. Officials in Zimbabwe are blaming anti-government rebels for this week's massacre of 16 church workers. Two Americans and six children were among the victims. UPI reporter Ian Mills says a government official today gave a possible reason for the killings.
He said the massacre appeared to be linked to a squatter problem at the commune. The government had recently warned the squatters they were to be moved to state-owned farms. He said the squatters were believed to have contacted the dissidents and asked them to stage the attack.
Officials say it was the worst massacre since Zimbabwe became independent in 1980. The death toll continues to rise in the Philippines after Typhoon Nina hit the country early yesterday. The government says the storm claimed at least 300 lives and has left more than 160,000 people homeless. Humphrey Hawksley has more from Manila.
President Corazon Aquino has declared a state of calamity in 11 provinces and on one island. The relief operation is centered on the province of Sorsogon on the southern tip of the island of Luzon. It bore the brunt of Typhoon Nina, which came ashore on Wednesday night with winds of more than 120 miles an hour. Hundreds of people have sought refuge in schools and churches. Officials say casualty figures are bound to rise and that more than 100,000 people have been made homeless by the storm. The Weather Bureau now says the area can expect more bad weather at the weekend. For National Public Radio, this is Humphrey Hawksley in Manila.
The most wanted man in Ireland has been arrested. Police say they captured Irish nationalist guerrilla Desi O'Hare after a gun battle at a roadblock today. O'Hare was known as the Desert Fox. He had vowed he would never be taken alive. Police say he was shot in the arms, legs, and chest when he tried to burst through a roadblock in a car. Police say he's a suspect in up to 30 murders. On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 36 points to close at 1,910.48. Volume was light, only 86 million shares. I'm Ann Bozell in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Accordionist William Schimmel helped spark the tango revival as a member of the ensemble The Tango Project. He also performed in the pit band for Joseph Papp's production of the Three Penny Opera. Tangos and the music of Kurt Weill are two of Schimmel's deepest passions.
Most people view the tango as a dance. Well, of course it's a dance, but it's much more than that. It's a state of mind, a state of being, existential despair, loneliness, oppression. It can be best described as Argentine blues. Like the blues, tangos originated in the brothels of Argentina. And all the seamy sides of life were, in a sense, explained in the dance and music of the tango. And the people could feel as they danced or sang a tango that feeling of loneliness, of being misplaced, and most of all, of being just plain in the wrong place at the wrong time. One of the most famous examples is La Comparsita. That's about a young gentleman who's in love with a girl of ill repute, and he wants to meet her at the ball to embrace her passionately. But he doesn't want to leave his sick tubercular mother, and she keeps telling him, "Stay with me, stay with me, stay with me." But he can't resist his passions, and he runs off into the night to embrace the woman, only to return home later on that evening to find his mother dead. And so he will spend the rest of his life in holy celibacy. Now, La Comparsita is known mostly to all of us by Hernando's Hideaway, which is one of the tags in La Comparsita. So it's the most famous tango ever written, and here it is. What does Kurt Weill and the tango have in common? Well, they both share three basic characteristics. They speak directly to the heart, the gut, and the soul. Kurt Weill appreciated the irony of the tango. He appreciated that beautiful operatic lyricism that was possible, and to put underneath that the basic hard-edged irony of that incessant tango beat. Yeah, 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 yeah. Yeah, yeah, almost punk. In Happy End, one of the primo examples of this treatment of the tango, he employs a beautiful singing lyrical line accompanied by a brittle, hard-edged accompaniment. ¶¶ And thanks to Kurt Vile and the Tango, I'm able to explore my own Argentine blues in my own original three-penny accordion suite. Here, I capture the fragrances and essences of three-penny opera in an original work, very much like Bertolt Brecht and Kurt Vile did in exploring John Gay's Beggar's Opera. And I'll leave you with this.
Accordionist William Schimmel is a founding member of the Tango Project, and he's based in New York. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Mark Halliday. He's one of five new poets chosen for publication in the National Poetry Series, a collaborative project of five leading publishing houses. Mark Halliday writes in a colloquial style. He's been influenced by popular culture and rock and roll, as well as by other poets. The title poem from his collection, Little Star, was inspired by this 1958 hit record by The Elegants.
Where are you, little star?
Little Star, 1. Little Star by The Elegants, 1958, is one of those perfect early rock pop songs that radiate confidence in a few orderly truths. Above all, if you have the right girl as your girlfriend, you know, the one who walks that way and tosses her hair, the one who dances just a little between cheers at the football game, if you've got her, you're golden. There's nothing else you could wish for. Oh, God, do you remember the golden liquidity of the lead singer's voice as he expresses this shapely truth? He could get it across without needing to rely on the mere meanings of words. He could do everything with golden syllables. Who was he? Can anybody tell me the name of the lead singer for The Elegants? In view of that grand confidence, it would seem a name worth preserving. Really, if you can give me his name, I'll give you $6. I thought of offering 10, but that seems more than I can afford, especially since his name may be fairly easy to discover. $5 nowadays seems paltry, so I'm offering 6. 2. This is not the first time I've tried to get a rock and roll song into a poem, and it won't be the last. It is my need to call out, "This counts too." I don't deny Homer or Virgil or Dante. I'll take your word for it about Bach and Beethoven. I don't question the importance of the Bible, though it never lived in my life. I love Shakespeare and admire Milton as much as you do. But our lives go on in these years, 1958, 1959, 1960, the 60s, and still on in these years like 1977, and still on now, as I write this in September 1980, with the sun bright almost as if new. And we are small. We are postmodern and small. but not therefore worthless. So it is for our sake that I try to insist upon the wafer-thin, golden value of a certain addition to the long, long, over-talented symphony of culture. Of course, it's no match for some hundreds or even thousands of novels, poems, operas, etc. we could name, nor for 50 rock songs I could name. But I want to say this also was not nothing. 3. Where is he now? The Elegants would be in their 40s now. Is he a vice president of Arista Records? Is he a wise, quiet junkie on the Lower East Side? Is he dead? Killed by something that golden syllables can't fix? Or maybe at this moment he sits with another Elegant in a Pizza Hut in L.A. planning the impossible comeback. If you can let me know where he is, I'll send him a fan letter. The unforeseeability of this gesture would make me feel, at least for a day, that a million debts were paid. However, the $6 will be yours for no information more than his name. His name. The point is just to make it true that someone 22 years after a small fact of art can unexpectedly pause and say, "This man sang lead on Little Star."
Did you ever find out the answer to the question, who sang lead on Little Star?
I did find it out. In fact, I have to confess I found it out quite a long time ago. I wrote the poem in 1980. It was published in a small press book in 1981, and right around that time I was informed that the lead singer of the Elegants was a man named Vito Piccone. The Elegants were an Italian group from Staten Island, and Little Star was their only real hit. So I paid the $6, and I kind of thought that maybe I'd written a poem that could never be published again, because I didn't want the gesture in the poem to seem fake. I've included Vito Piccone's name in the acknowledgments page of the book among people that I thank as a way of sort of tipping off sharp-eyed readers that I have learned the guy's name.
You use a lot of vocal group songs in your poems. And, you know, I always thought that one function of pop music was to express the sentiments that we'd be too embarrassed or too shy to express ourselves, especially in love songs. I wonder if you think in a way that songs have taken the role of poetry in putting those sentiments into words.
Well, it's clear that I have very strong feelings about the relation between pop songs, rock and roll songs, and my daily life. In other words, like most of us, I guess, who are anywhere near my age, rock and roll is very deeply in our minds going back to adolescence. So I don't know if this exactly answers your question, but often when I write a poem, a driving impulse is to try to match the evocative quality that I associate with some of these songs.
You know what I think it is, too, in some of those songs? The urgency of the people who sang them, especially like a group from the Elegants, an Italian group from Staten Island, probably working class, has all these dreams of great girlfriends, of making it, probably of getting out of the neighborhood. And even though the lyrics are really corny, like "Twinkle, twinkle, little star, how I wonder where you are," when you sing it with the kind of urgency that the group does, it starts to mean something beyond the words.
Yeah, I feel that about that song. Every time I hear it, there's a kind of desperate yearning that the guy gets into his voice.
Would you like your poems to have that kind of urgency that speaks to people the way songs always speak to us?
I have a strong desire to get through to people. Maybe most poets would say that. But I think I'm more willing to risk what many readers would, especially sophisticated readers, would consider banality or obviousness. I'm more willing to risk that for the sake of having an impact and getting through to someone and not seeming like just another formal academic exercise.
One of the things you're doing in your poems is writing in a very colloquial style, speaking in a speech-like way. Did you ever go through a period yourself where you thought that the poetry had to be more formal?
I think ever since I was an undergraduate, I wanted to write poems that were very close to my speaking voice, but they didn't seem very approved by the authority figures that I ran into or read. In 1978, when I was in graduate school, I met the poet Frank Bidart, who was rapidly became then and still is my most important advisor and reader or mentor. And a big thing that he did for me was to give me confidence that a poem could be deeply serious while very colloquial and seemingly conversational in its tone and diction.
I get the impression from some of your poems that sometimes you're overtaken by this sense of futility as a poet, of describing things and of giving your take on things, knowing that there's thousands and thousands of other writers who are in their rooms describing things and delivering their take on things.
Yeah. Yeah, that can be depressing if you become conscious that at any given moment, I mean, right now as we sit here speaking, the typewriters are just going, you know, like a noise, the sound of a million locusts across the land, clacking away. All those poems are coming out. And you can get into a mood where you're really depressed by the fact that no one will have time to read them all.
But obviously poems really do mean a lot to you, poems that you've read and poems that you write. And why does poetry count so much in your life?
Is it because I can't play guitar? Of course, there have been many, many poems for me that have had an effect on my life. Maybe as strong. Yeah, I do think in some way as strong as the effect on my life that that songs have had. And, you know, I've wanted to recreate that kind of effect, that kind of gathering of significance that I've found in poems.
Mark Halliday, I want to thank you very much for talking with us about your poems.
Thank you. It's been fun.
Mark Halliday's collection of poems, Little Star, is published by William Morrow. Halliday teaches at the University of Pennsylvania. This is Fresh Air. You can hear full coverage of today's news on All Things Considered. Robert Siegel co-hosts the program, and he's joining us from Washington. Hi, Robert.
Hello, Terry.
What's coming up?
Well, we'll be following the latest on the prison takeovers, also reports of a hostage release in Lebanon, and about the pre-election violence in Haiti. We also have an item from the All Things Considered archives.
Oh, what are you playing?
We're playing an old report from 1980, but still very, very current. It was about the New Hampshire primary campaigns, and how they sort of passed through one small town in New Hampshire, Claremont, as they were seen by a young man who was then 18 years old and was the son of the mayor. So we'll have that look back at Claremont, New Hampshire, 1980 this evening.
Thanks, Robert. Those stories and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Comedian Harry Shearer appeared in the heavy metal spoof This is Spinal Tap and spent 2 years as a cast member of Saturday Night Live. He's recently done cable specials, and he now hosts a weekly radio show on NPR member station KCRW in Santa Monica. Shearer also plays the comedy clubs, and our critic-at-large Laurie Stone recently caught his act in New York. She says his comedy is informed by a deep understanding of his cultural and political targets.
Harry Shearer has the most coherent anti-establishment politics of any stand-up comedian working today. I recently caught his act at Caroline's Comedy Club in New York, and I came out feeling hopeful. I'm looking forward to the end of Reagan-era art and entertainment, stuff marketed as consumer goods with nothing critical or disturbing inside. Shearer is probably best known for his hilarious turn in the movie Spinal Tap, playing the fictional heavy metalist Derek Smalls. Shearer does Smalls in his act, his scraggly mop and red spandex pants still intact. He's into Christian rock now, not a real departure. We weren't Satanists per se, but I've always believed a man's relationship with the supreme evil one is a very private matter. In another bit, Shearer is Blackwell, the smarmy L.A. talk show host. He stares into the camera, piercing the boundaries of the TV screen with classic evangelist bravura. His religion is trivia. His guest is Bobby Boucher, who's been doing Irma LaDuce for 25 years and now has a gig at the James Franciscus Dinner Theater. Shearer, who is slight and dark-haired, is a wry, agile performer. Out of character, he wears a Juilliard quietness on his intelligent face, but he transforms himself in every bit. He gets inside Smalls and Blackwell. There's no winking or holding back. A part of him identifies with the salesmen and egoists he especially enjoys lampooning, and the affinity deepens his takes. By acknowledging his responsiveness to his targets, Shearer affirms their power and also places himself on the firing line for self-promotion, lost dreams, and vanity. By crossing over into his characters, he lets us see what slithers beneath their psyches while preserving their humanness. This satire of recognition is quintessential Bob and Ray. You see it, too, in Paul Schaefer's Vegas Smoothies and in Billy Crystal's Old Jewish Cranks. It's the opposite of the snarl and put-down school of comedy epitomized by David Letterman and the recent Saturday Night Live show, a style that dominates the stand-up stage and TV because it's so much easier to feel contempt than to evolve a point of view. Shearer's humor is grounded in news and media. His Reagan is a rambler whose ignorance doesn't eclipse his perniciousness. In a radio address, Ronnie fumes, "If this country had a few more Ollie Norths and a lot fewer Arthur Lymans, there'd be a lot less seeds in our rye bread." Some of Shearer's sharpest work rips open TV, that great traveling salesman in the skies. Five monitors sit on stage, and between the live pieces, he shows his videos. In one, he perfectly impersonates Laurie Anderson, voice distortions, white tux, and all. She's doing a maxi pad commercial. But the funniest and most ingenious piece is the video Shredding Party. Three black Marines boogie across the desks of the Senate hearing room and sing the zippy refrain, Shredding Party. And while a giant shredder churns out reams of confetti, Arthur Lyman, in perfect rhythm, keeps asking McFarlane, "What did he tell you about a shredding party?" And McFarlane keeps replying, "Well, just that there had to be one." This video zaps the media's penchant for choreographing history, as well as our appetite for this kind of entertainment. Shearer gets laughs without ever trading away his social vision. Don't miss his Cinemax specials or his show when he tours. And the person of Shearer, brainy, irreverent, underground comedy, is surfacing once more.
Lurie Stone is a writer and critic based in New York and a contributor to The Village Voice. Here's a look at the next Fresh Air. Next time, I'll speak with John Doe and Exene Cervenka, songwriters and singers with the L.A. rock band X. Also, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead will review the new album by bassist Dave Holland and his quintet. And television critic David Bianculli will chart the progress of the shows that premiered earlier this fall. And they'll give a quick history of how television's top programs fared in their first year. So I hope you can join us. And we'd like to hear from you. Write us with your comments and suggestions. The address is Fresh Air, WHYY Radio, Independence Mall West, Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, 19106. That's Fresh Air, WHYY Radio, Independence Mall West, Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, 19106. We thank everyone who helps make Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person. Ed Doherty and Lisa Bruton are the production assistants. Our engineer is Richard Parker. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.